okay, so I'm behind the time. I'm not on Facebook and I don't fucking tweet shit, but I am on Instagram. So come follow me or whatever at OCD Straight Talk.
All right, my friends, thanks for tuning into the podcast, where, as always, we'll discuss the professional literature and the evidence-based protocol as they relate to the effective treatment of clinically significant anxiety symptoms. I'm Chris Lines, licensed psychotherapist and OCD spectrum disorders treatment specialist, and this, well, this is OCD Straight Talk.
Dr. Kathleen Rapertis, licensed clinical psychologist and anxiety disorders and OCD treatment specialist, founder and clinical director of Anxiety and OCD Treatment Center in Wilmington, Delaware, co-author of the acclaimed Loving Someone with OCD, a top-rated book written specifically to loved ones of OCD sufferers, and not only a respected colleague, but a great friend of mine. Dr. Rapertis, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks so much, Chris, for having me.
Great privilege. So I want to begin with a fairly common but really practical question. How do I tell the difference between OCD thoughts and real world concerns?
Yeah. So it's a good question. And I think what that illustrates is that the content of obsessions are not specific to OCD. In some instances they are, but very often there are everyday kinds of questions, concerns, or uncertainties that we live with. And we all kind of draw the line in a different place, right? Some people will always wash their hands after they go to the bathroom. Other people will most of the time, but if they're in a rush, they can leave without washing their hands. And so everybody's kind of line is very different from each other. And the way to sort of tell, the way I think about OCD versus regular behavior is just the amount of distress that would be involved, not just in the ritual, but if they were prevented from doing the ritual, prevented from figuring it out, prevented from washing their hands, the duration or the amount of time that those thoughts occupy. So perhaps somebody who has just regular contamination concerns, non-OCD concerns, they might think to themselves, geez, I got to get back to my meeting. I don't even have time to wash my hands. And they feel a little disturbed by that. And then halfway down the hallway to their office, they've forgotten about it. And so there's this flexibility when we're not talking about OCD, that with the OCD is not the case. There's that rigidity. It's time consuming, it's distressing, and it has a significant impact.
Nice. So other than the flexibility piece that you mentioned, which I think is really applicable to listeners, you're taking this from a DSM point of view, where you're looking at the sense of emotionality that's associated with the intrusive thoughts, the felt need to engage compulsive sure. patterns. And so bringing back around the concept of flexibility, there's this idea that, well, if I can sort of let go of these intrusive thoughts and I don't have this intense need to engage compulsions, then maybe it's not OCD.
Sure. Absolutely. Yes. Yes. We all have, as I said, it's not the content of these thoughts. And, you know, there was Rockman and De Silva did a book on the nature of OCD. It's like 1978. And they have a whole long list of obsessions that are experienced by like the non-OCD population. And it looks very much like what we would see in our OCD population. It's just that they don't have that lowered threshold for uncertainty. And so it just sort of passes through. They're like, eh, that thought doesn't feel so good. And then they're able to move on. Yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting. It kind of raises the concept again of a continuum of symptomatology or symptom severity, where everybody has, I mean, listeners have heard me say a lot of times that a research shows about 90% of the general population experiences at least occasional unwanted thoughts. Sure. So lots and lots of us can, that is to say, including the non-clinical population, can have these unwanted thoughts and feel something of a distress elicited by them. And even maybe engage compulsions like checking the alarm clock, for example, once we set it, or jiggling the doorknob when we lock the door, et cetera. And that's interesting. So again, there's this concept of of symptom severity and clinical significance.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes. Yeah. And of course, we know there's the neurobiobehavioral model. And so there's just certain ways that the brain functions differently, at least prior to treatment, where they're just more responsive to that uncertainty and more likely to feel anxious and then need to respond to that in some way.
So with this in mind, we're talking about the kind of continuum of symptom severity. What is the best way for people to begin to approach their symptoms in terms of turning down the volume on severity? If there's just a difference in the amount of time that's consumed by symptoms and the amount of distress that's associated with the experience of intrusive thoughts, what is it that individuals should be directed to do in terms of beginning to turn down the volume on their symptoms?
For the OCD sufferer, you mean?
Yeah,
of course. Okay. So as we all, well, many of us know that we can't directly impact what we think. What we think is what we think. And however, we can influence that through the way we respond to those thoughts, meaning either engaging in rituals or refraining from those and learning to live with the uncertainty about what that thought means, what it may say about us as an individual, and so forth. So by refraining from the rituals, the obsessions themselves will become less intense and less frequent over time in a vast majority of cases.
Now, you mentioned the word uncertainty a couple of times.
Yes.
And it's something that I talk about quite a bit on the podcast as well. But I'd love to get your take on, well, what do you mean by uncertainty? What do you want listeners to kind of take away from this idea?
Yeah, sure. So John Grayson, one of my mentors who I was fortunate enough to work with many years ago, is the first one that presented this concept that what it is for OCD sufferers is the inability to tolerate uncertainty. Now, biologically speaking, all of us feel distressed when we experience a certain level of uncertainty, and that's a good thing. We should wonder what the footsteps are behind us, or why is our door open when we didn't remember leaving that open. It should make us anxious enough to explore and get an answer and determine, is there a threat or is there not, right? So that anxiety doesn't mean there's something amiss. It means there could be, and we need to look into that. For the individual with OCD, their threshold for uncertainty is much, much lower. So I'll often explain this as thinking about two different mouse traps. And one mouse trap, the non-OCD, it might take dropping a big pen on that to set that mousetrap off and respond with uncertainty and get that circuitry in the brain going and that anxiety activated. For the individual with OCD, it's more like a paperclip. A paperclip sets it off, right? So something with much less weight and gravity to it will set that circuitry into play. And then, of course, we're driven to reduce that anxiety. And so the idea that it's driven by the uncertainty is the person wants to have 100% certainty that whatever they're fearful of, or again, whatever it may say about them, isn't going to happen. And that just doesn't exist. We live quite well and adapt quite well to uncertainty in everyday situations, but there are these certain pockets of themes and topics where for the individual with OCD, that circuitry is set off and just runs amok for that individual. And so the real core of treatment is to learn to live with the uncertainty that maybe I did leave the door unlocked or maybe I didn't. Maybe I will be responsible for something horrible happening, maybe I won't. And being able to respond to that in the way that they do in their non-OCD moments, mm-hmm. how they respond to the uncertainty there, helping them to respond that way to their obsessional content.
Maybe I will, maybe I won't.
Yes, yes.
Okay,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Good. So now there's a fair amount of individuals who are providing treatment for OCDers.
Yeah.
That approach this concept of uncertainty more from a point of view of disconfirming beliefs.
Yeah.
And so that's pretty common in the literature. It's not something that I'm particularly, Yeah, unfortunately, agreed. And not something that I'm particularly sympathetic to, and quite obviously you're not either. You mentioned John Grayson and others as well, who are not finding that to be advantageous.
Yes.
Question is, what are your thoughts in terms of the advantage or the efficacy of disconfirming beliefs within the context of OCD treatment?
Yeah. So what I see is that inevitably it just becomes the ritual of reassurance. And then it's now encouraging the person to try to weigh out what's the probability of X or Y happening, or what's the probability that it means I am a pedophile or a murderer in disguise. And they're just then traveling down the road of more rituals and greater compulsions. And, you know, to the person coming into treatment and people not familiar with OCD treatment, it can sound pretty bizarre and radical. Like, wait, what, you want me to learn to live with the possibility that I'm a pedophile? But none of us can prove that we're not, right? Again, we're living with uncertainty every single day.
Or none of us can prove that we're not capable of that kind of behavior.
We're not capable of that, right?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so, it may sound sort of radical, but at the same time, you know, we live with the uncertainty every day that when we're driving home, we could die, right? We could die on our way home.
Right.
And if every single person thought about that when they got into their car, they might have a knee-jerk reaction to like, oh, I don't like that idea. Yet they're going to start up their car and they're going to drive home. And if we asked every single person every day when they got into a car, do you think that you're going to arrive alive? I think everybody's going to say, yeah, probably. But the reality is that there's a good handful of people and their best guess was wrong. Right. And so we're risking our lives to go to Rita's to get a water ice or someplace to get our coffee. But we're willing to assume that our best guess is right. And when are we going to deal with the possibility of that being wrong? Basically when it's too late.
Mm.
Right. But we're able to live with that. And that's the concept that we're trying to help the person with OCD to apply to their obsessional themes. It's that same idea.
But why would I live with that if I can disconfirm the belief? If I can prove that intrusive thought is not a valid fear, as patients will often say, I know that thought is irrational. I know it's irrational. If we can somehow arrive at an empirical place that we're demonstrating that this thought is not true, why wouldn't we do that?
Yeah. Well, with OCD, it's not a problem with the person's logic. And most of the time, if you say to a person, okay, what is your best guess? What do you think if we factor out the OCD? They know, like they know it's irrational. They know that this doesn't make sense, but OCD or not, we're driven by irrational thoughts all of the time. Irrational thoughts aren't in control though. It's the emotions about that. And being able to dispute something, but not experience that, that's what's missing. That's what's going to help to align their thoughts and their emotions. And it's only by going through the exposure and experiencing the anxiety and uncertainty that then their thoughts and their emotions start to line up. But we can't talk ourselves out of an emotion. If so, we wouldn't have OCD.
Yeah.
The distress is because they keep trying. It doesn't work. It works enough to keep them trying and trying and trying,
right,
but intermittently, and then down the rabbit hole they go, and more their life is lost to the disorder.
Yeah.
I think that your point about reassurance is a fucking bullseye. I think that's exactly right. The concept that we're disconfirming a belief is ultimately falling directly into the category provided by the American Psychiatric Association of the definition of compulsion, right? It's something that we're doing expressly for the purpose of reducing our anxiety or dismissing or getting rid of an unwanted thought. It's exactly the purpose of disconfirming the belief. And I think that's a major problem when it comes to the efficacy of treatment, but I think that there's this other major problem that arrives, and there's a sense of, well, what if it does happen in the future? You know, what if, you know, I've disconfirmed the likelihood of the car accident and I can get into the car and fast forward a year or two or whatever. And at this point I've gotten in the car many, many thousands of times, but then that one day I get into a car accident.
Right.
And it unravels all of that work that I did because I wasn't accepting the concept of uncertainty. And at any point, I could act out sexually. At any point, I could touch something and become very, very ill. At some point, I could try and harm myself or in a fit of rage, try and harm. So there's the capability within myself. Excellent. All right. So let's change gears a bit if we could.
Yeah.
I'd really love to talk to you about this topic. So how can loved ones support OCD sufferers without participating in their symptoms? I think many family members intuitively grasp that reassurance does not pacify obsessional distress. It's not a particularly helpful intervention.
Yeah, that's a nice time.
Right. But when you're living with somebody who's dealing with OCD, who's regularly demanding practical help with routine tasks and repeatedly asking for reassurance, not acquiescing is way easier said than done.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Right. So just as the irrational thoughts are so dominant and driving in OCD, it is in our everyday life and when we're living with somebody with OCD and you know, the distress that's caused, we also want to try to get a break from that as quickly as possible. And in the book, I refer to the rituals and accommodating behaviors and enabling that family members often find themselves in as pseudo rituals, right? Rituals serve to alleviate the distress of the moment and they work sometimes. And so the person keeps engaging in that. And for family members, it's the same thing. They may logically be saying, I know that this isn't going to work, but they could remember a time that their reassurance did work. And then the family was able to leave and have a great afternoon, right? And all they're thinking is, well, how horrible is the afternoon going to be if I don't provide this reassurance? And so, well, it's just easier in the short run to just give that reassurance, right? So there's the role of that irrational thinking. There's just wanting a sense of peace for themselves and for their loved one. And it's just very natural outside of the OCD realm. Providing reassurance is a really good way of showing that you're empathizing with someone and you're being compassionate and you care and you're trying to protect them. It just backfires. Everything is opposite with OCD. And things that seem like they're going to help make things worse. And the things you think are going to make things worse make things better.
So your initial point, I think, is really important to listeners that this shit makes sense, right? Yeah. It makes sense. There's a sense in which we're saying we love our family member when we're offering that reassurance. We're being supportive. We're trying to be there for him or for her and walk with them through this really trying and difficult season of time known as the OCD episode, et cetera. But then what we're finding on the back end of this is it's really counterproductive.
Absolutely. And all kinds of research out there showing that family accommodation correlates with the individual symptom severity and the family dysfunction because of the OCD. And when we decrease accommodating behaviors, we have better treatment outcomes. All kinds of research strongly supporting that. Nobody doubts that being the case.
But I think here's the question. So you and I know, the literature knows, the listeners know that, look, we need to be able to identify and stop compulsions in the process of treatment, that there's a genuine sense, I would argue, that even if we're just focusing on targeted behavior change, we're sort of by extension doing exposure therapy, and the likelihood that we're going to make progress is exponentially higher. Fine. But the reality is we're talking about the loved one, right? The loved one who is sort of being pulled into this madness and is trying to walk on eggshells, so to speak, and keep peace in the house. Sure. What to your mind can be done what is good advice for the family member who's not engaging the compulsion, but maybe by extension is for the OCDer? What can he or she do?
Yeah. Well, I think the best thing to do, is to to talk about it ahead of time. The worst time to try to figure out what to do is when both parties are really anxious and needing something from the other person that they just aren't able to give. And so things will just then escalate. So a lot of it is setting out a plan ahead of time. Coming to some sort of an agreement, and that's not always easy. Some families are able to manage that without the formality of therapy, and in some more complex situations, then a therapist is really highly recommended to help the family navigate that and to identify situations where OCD is likely to get triggered and to engage in just like a discussion of, if this happens, here's what I as a family member am going to do. So maybe instead of completely withholding reassurance, maybe we start with, I'm going to reassure you two times. And then after that, I'm going to respond to you with, I love you too much to keep reassuring you. Or I think nice. You can live with the uncertainty of that. And having that, again, agreed upon ahead of time so that the person with OCD doesn't feel that they're being abandoned. And I think for the family member, for them to not feel as though they're abandoning their loved one, which is oftentimes what that can feel like. And if we can help the family member realize that this is loving someone, this is, right? Loving someone when it feels all good and warm and fuzzy, that's the easy part. The hard part of loving someone is judiciously withholding things from them because we have some bit of information or wisdom that they don't, that this is not good for you or for us. And that's really, really hard. And I think that's the crux of why a lot of family members end up accommodating is yeah. They feel that they're being unloving and cold, and they also have a difficult time regulating their own emotions around their loved one's distress, and it mm-hmm. just become overwhelming very quickly. So having agreed upon plan ahead of time.
And there's this kind of tough love element, it sounds like you're pointing to, yeah. where when the loved one is withholding that reassurance, there's this pretty genuine and heavy sense in which the OCDer is sort of forced to face the music. Yes. And I'm not going to help you with your symptoms. And what that is generally going to do after we throw a fit and create a problem and all these things is it's going to begin to turn the attention of the OCDer to the motivation that, look, it's just me in the road now. I've got to work to make progress because you know, he or she's just, you know, not helping me out anymore.
Yeah. And I think that's a natural part of just knowing that you have a safety net, right? I think all of us would just try a little less difficult or less hard if we know that there's kind of something there that's sort of going to support us. And unfortunately, that prevents us from seeing what we're really capable of doing. And that's what I love about this treatment is that I tell my clients that, yeah, our goal at the end of treatment is that you have less OCD and you're able to go out there and live your life. But what I think that they gather from this is a greater sense of confidence in themselves than they would have if they never had to deal with OCD. I think that it leaning into anxiety and taking reasonable risks can open a lot of doors for a person who typically may not walk through them. And I think they learn a lot about themselves in treatment. Kind of like, if I can do this, I can do anything. You learn to fail a lot in treatment and get back up again and keep going. So the only way to do that is through trial and error, you know, and in the same way that parents let their children fall when they're learning to walk and they get their bumps and bruises and sometimes a trip to the emergency room. But eventually, you know, you see the smile on your child's face as they're walking and they're just so proud of themselves. And so it's that same thing you're wanting for your loved one, is them to have that sense of independence and confidence in themselves. It's going to carry them forward. And why would we want to keep that from our loved one?
Yeah, that's a good question. And the idea is walking through the difficulty of whatever it's going to mean interpersonally in order for a hope for a different tomorrow.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It can make families a whole lot closer. You know, it can really pull a family together, but it also has the potential, when not managed, to just really cause a lot of suffering and a lot of broken relationships in the family and parents being torn and you know, the tendency of one family member to come down hard and then the other one to try to compensate and things just, you know, within the family system can really become off balance.
What are your thoughts on behavioral contracting?
I love behavioral contracting. Barbara Van Noppen did a lot of the original, I think it was her concept from the very beginning, which she was kind enough to allow us to borrow for the Loving Someone with OCD book. And we do have a chapter in there about behavioral contracting. And what I like about that is it does a lot of the things that we've talked about in a very structured sort of a way. It lays out, here's what the exposure is, or here's the problematic situation. Here's how the loved one is going to respond. And it spells out what they're going to do, when they're going to do it, how they're going to do it. What I really like about that plan is that there's also usually a reward that is involved in it. And I think when appropriate, it's good to have a reward that both the loved one and the person with OCD can do together, because this is not easy. It's not easy for the person with OCD, and it's not easy for that family member. So if it's some sort of a reward that if they abide by that contract and follow through, each of them on their part, that there's some sort of a reward, something that they'll get to do together or buy together that normally they wouldn't, to just celebrate that they're taking these really difficult but positive steps.
Yeah. Excellent. Really appreciate your expertise, Dr. Rupertus.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Yeah, great to have you on the podcast. Thanks very much.
All right, thank you.
Well, that's it for another episode of OCD Straight Talk. Feel free to reach out with any questions you might have to chrislines04@gmail.com. If you found the podcast helpful, consider giving it a 5-star rating or support OCD Straight Talk to help us produce more content.